Lessons from the Spanish flu pandemic a century after it devastated the world. Think back to your middle school or high school history class and what you learned about World War I. You probably remember the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and the sinking of the Lusitania. But did you learn about the Spanish flu? Did you know that the flu killed millions during World War I, far more people than the war did? That President Woodrow Wilson was hit by the flu badly during peace negotiations, and that likely affected the Treaty of Versailles? I'm Jennifer Rooks. A new young adult history book explores the devastating pandemic, World War I, and lessons for us now. Its author, Kenneth C. Davis, joins us on today's program. Why is the 1918 pandemic flu such an important and overlooked part of history? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. 100 years ago, a pandemic took the lives of tens of millions of people. A new book by best-selling author Kenneth C. Davis chronicles the deadly disease and how it changed the course of history. Ken joins us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. You remember Ken from his other appearances on our program to talk about various aspects of America's hidden history. His new book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Hi, Ken. Welcome back.
It is always a pleasure to be with you, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled to have you. I need to let our audience know that we do very much want to hear your questions, but right now we're having trouble with our phones, so do not call in. Please send us a question via email. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can still tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And try to do that a little earlier in the hour than you might if you called, in case there's a little bit of a lag. But we'd love to hear your questions or observations about the Spanish flu, the pandemic flu of 1918, maybe how it's affected our thinking today, what you do or don't know about it, or if it affected people in your life. Have you heard stories from your grandparents? And Ken, I'm always curious how you get your ideas for your books. I mean, history is replete with good ideas. Why this one?
Well, two things. First of all, I'm always looking for the stories that the school books leave out, that the history books leave out. And there's no greater example of that story than the Spanish flu pandemic, which was absolutely erased from not only the history books, but popular memory in some ways. The most deadly epidemic in American history really was forgotten. In fact, one of the first historians to talk about it called it America's forgotten pandemic. But the other story was more personal to what you were just speaking to the callers about. I was in the office of my publisher, and my editor was coughing and sneezing, and we got talking about the flu, and she said, "Oh, my grandmother died in the Spanish flu pandemic." And I said, "That's a fascinating story. I'd love." And she said, "Well, if you want to write that book, let's do it." So it really started at the book started with a conversation by the elevators with a flu-stricken editor.
Oh, and, no.
She is well.
Good.
I am happy to say. And but the story of this flu, and we call it the flu, but it was so much worse than what we think of as influenza or the flu. It knocks us on our back for a few days. This was something that was so grotesque and violent and virulent that people were actually dropping dead on the streets. They were choking on their own body fluids. I hope nobody's having lunch. They were turning blue because they were couldn't get enough oxygen to their lungs. They were bleeding from their noses and ears sometimes. So that's why doctors thought, this is not just the flu. This is something different. And some of the most experienced medical researchers of the day didn't think that this was the flu. They actually thought it's some new kind of plague. And because it was World War I, there was also the suggestion, the rumor, the thought that maybe the Germans were doing this. U-boats were dropping off poisoned water, or that Bayer, a German company, was poisoning aspirin, its new wonder drug. And that connection between World War I and the Spanish flu is really the story that this book talks about.
Well, and there's so many fascinating angles, and I'm sure you discovered lots of surprises as you were investigating. I want to step back, though, Ken. Give us an idea of the scale of this pandemic. How deadly was it?
The scope is unimaginable in many ways today. We're talking about, the estimates have been changing as time goes by. I've seen estimates now as high as 100 million people around the world, including 20 million people in India alone. That's a large number, but we're talking about that number dying within the space of about a year. We're talking about 5% of the world population. In the United States, the estimates are now up around 675,000 people. That's a huge number, of course. 100 years ago, it was a huge number. If we multiplied that out based on population today, we'd be talking about three times as many people dying, close to 2 million people dying of the flu in a little more than a year's time. Of course, today we have a bad flu season and about 50,000 people died. This dwarfed that in every respect.
You tell, one of the things that's so wonderful about your books, Kenneth, is how you personalize it. And you tell the story pretty near the beginning of the book of two young men who sign up to go off to war and instead get the flu. And these are people that you might have heard their names, right?
Well, one of them certainly, their names were Russell and Walt, and they were 16 years old, and they were in Chicago. And like a lot of red-blooded young American boys, they wanted to do anything to get into a uniform. The whole country was singing "Over There." The posters of Uncle Sam were all around saying, "I want you." The Navy posters showed this beautiful woman beckoning the sailors to come join the Navy. So Russell and Walt try to sign up, but they're too young. They learn that the Red Cross ambulance service takes younger men. And even though they're not 17 yet, they both try to sign up for the Red Cross ambulance service. Walt, who was a pretty good artist, actually had to change his birth certificate to make it. And he signs up but gets sick and has to go home where he nearly dies. Of course, it's Walt Disney. That's a pretty extraordinary story in its own right. The other one I talk about has perhaps even more impact on world history is the fate of a young assistant secretary of the Navy who gets the flu in Europe, comes back on a troop ship, is taken to his mother's apartment in New York City, and very, very much close to death, is nursed back to health. His name is Franklin D. Roosevelt. Of course, he then goes on to become president and leads the country through the Great Depression and the next World War.
You know, one of the things I thought when I read that Walt Disney and FDR both survived, almost died, both of them, but also ended up surviving, is how much talent and possibility was lost. How many young men and women don't have that story. We're not hearing their stories because the flu took their lives.
Absolutely, and that is part of the extraordinary aspect of this. It was an equal opportunity killer. It took presidents and generals and kings and artists and famous people, but it took, of course, millions of average people. It took soldiers and civilians. It took Africans and Alaskans. There was very little discrimination in the flu once it started making its way around the world. And that's why it is so closely connected with World War I, of course, is that this did become a global pandemic because of the war.
Right, millions people were traveling on ships and troops. Entire ships were turning into incubators of death.
That's right. So, someone famously described the boats carrying Americans over to Europe as floating caskets because before they even got to the trenches, which were horrible, they were dying on the ships that were carrying them back and forth. There's a famous boat, the one that Roosevelt himself was on, called Leviathan. It had actually been a German passenger ship that was confiscated early in the war, and then converted into a troop carrier. There are stories of 11,000 men being on this ship, and they are crowded together below decks, and the nightmarish stories of people walking through blood and body fluids and dying bodies on this ship is really something out of, we could say, a zombie movie. This is Walking Dead material.
So, Kenneth, this is the big question here. Why do we not know about this? Why do people only maybe have a paragraph in their history book?
It's a very good question, and I'm not sure I have a really perfect answer. I think there are a couple things at play. First of all, we tend to, as historians, I should say, tend to discount things like disease when we talk about history, and especially the history of war. So we talk about the causes of the war, the reasons for the war, what the politicians do or don't do, what the generals do. We spend a lot of time talking about military history, and we leave out the fact, in general, when it comes to war and history, of what things like disease actually mean. Of course, throughout history, disease has killed many more people than wars ever have. That's one of the reasons I titled the book More Deadly Than War. But the other aspect of this, I think, is more perhaps psychological, that this flu, this pandemic, was so catastrophic and so horrific, coming in twin with the losses of the war, people just wanted to forget about it. They didn't want to think about it. Even the men who were involved with looking for, mostly men, I should say, researchers, there were certainly women, even the people who were involved very closely with the search for the cure of this medical mystery, because it was a mystery to them, didn't write much about it in their own memoirs. It's quite extraordinary. It was a form of collective amnesia, I suppose. Even our pop culture neglected this in many respects. There are no great novels of the Spanish flu, for instance. There are no movies about the Spanish flu. No plays were written about it. There's one brilliant short story called Pale Horse, Pale Rider, by Catherine Ann Porter, who herself nearly died of the flu, and wrote this one story about a young journalist who wants to become a Red Cross nurse, and instead she falls sick. It's very autobiographical. So that story is about the best literary attempt we have at capturing what the flu is about. But other than that, we don't have an Angels in America, for instance, or a Philadelphia about the flu the way we did about the AIDS epidemic. And I should just point out that about as many Americans died in 1 year of the flu as have died in 30 years from HIV and AIDS. That, again, tries to put this into some perspective for us.
Well, in some other perspective, you write that in 1 year, as many people died from the flu as in all of the wars of modern day combined.
That's right. World War I, World War II, Korea and Vietnam in particular, this was larger than that loss. And many of the losses in World War I, you have to go back and look how many of the soldiers who died in World War I and are listed as casualties of war were actually flu casualties. That number might be as high as 40 or 50,000 men dying in service of the flu.
We're talking with Kenneth C. Davis. His new book, More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. We are having trouble with our phones, so if you'd like to ask a question or join the conversation, we'd love you to do that via email at talk@mainpublic.org, by posting on our Facebook page, we have a post up for today's program, or by tweeting at Maine Calling. So please join us via email, Facebook, or Twitter. We're talking about the Spanish flu of 1918, the pandemic. Kenneth, we were talking about why this has not gone down in the history books, but one thing I learned from your book that was so interesting is even looking at history in the traditional way, trying to figure out what causes wars and how they end and things like that, the flu may have and likely did influence the outcome of the war. The Germans may not have given up as soon as they did.
There's no question that in the spring of 1918, 100 years ago, just as the first American troops are beginning to arrive in March, April, and even into June of 1918, the Germans were mounting a major offensive aimed at driving the British and the French into the sea before America got involved in the war. Just to refresh everyone's memory here, August 1914 is the beginning of the war, primarily between Britain, France, and its allies against Germany and its allies. the war had gone back and forth for 3 years with tremendous, tremendous, unthinkable losses. This was the first war fought with modern weaponry on an industrial scale, and the losses were staggering. The United States had stayed out of it. President Woodrow Wilson had campaigned on a platform of, he kept us out of war. But in 1917, the United States finally does declare war on Germany, but it takes almost another year before the first troops are ready to go to Europe. The United States had no real standing army in 1917, a very tiny navy. So we began this massive armaments program and a draft. The Selective Service Act was passed during World War I. So a million young men were getting ready to go to the trenches of Europe, and they were in these cantonments, as they were called, training camps, and that's where the flu really started to bubble around. There's no question that once the Americans arrive, they bring that flu with them, and certainly that German offensive that I just mentioned was stalled. It was halted, and even the German commander later wrote that it was because 500,000 of his soldiers were down with what they called then Flanders fever. That's part of the story here as well. This disease had different names in different places, although it's most famously now the Spanish flu.
And so, and another way in which the flu may likely have influenced history is President Wilson, that during the peace negotiations, well, the Treaty of Versailles was being negotiated and written, he was stricken.
He was deathly ill. A surgeon thought that he might have been poisoned. Of course, we're talking now about the war ends on November 11th. The fighting ends on November 11th, 1918, the 11th day of the 11th month at the 11th hour. And then the victorious Allies get together in Versailles, not too much negotiate with the Germans as dictate to the Germans what the terms of peace will be. Wilson had gone to Paris with a very clear sense of what he wanted to accomplish, including the creation of the League of Nations, as you probably know. But he gets sick. And many historians of that moment, of the Versailles Treaty, look at the fact that Wilson clearly changed some of his views. And there is the suggestion, it's not mine, it's been shared by others, including his biographers, that something happened to Wilson as a result of this flu, that his judgment, his resolve, his will were all clearly affected by his illness. Did that, in fact, then change the terms of the Versailles Treaty? Perhaps they did. And of course, we know the Versailles Treaty had such tremendous ramifications for history going forward. We're still dealing with the results of what happened at Versailles in 1919. Of course, most famously, the prediction was Europe would be at war within 25 years. It actually only took 20 years, of course, for Germany to rearm and go back to war in 1939.
We're talking with Kenneth C. Davis, the author of the new book, More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Bar Harbor Savings and Loan, a local community bank dedicated to providing local, personalized loan and deposit services since 1902. Maine Public Radio is taking part in a national survey on the current and changing media habits of public radio listeners around the country, and we need your help. You may be among randomly chosen listeners who receive an email from Rob Holt, our Director of Digital, asking you to take this national survey, looking into how you use radio along with social media, smartphones, tablets, streaming, and the internet to stay connected. So thanks in advance. This survey will allow us here at Maine Public Radio to better serve you in the years ahead. Well, in other news, tonight is the night. We'll determine the statewide champion of High School Quiz Show Maine tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television. Falmouth and Bangor go head-to-head to answer questions about math, science, history, pop culture, Maine, and other subjects. The state champion will then head down to Boston to compete in the regional semifinals, which you can watch this Saturday evening from 6 to 7. Join us for the High School Quiz Show Maine Championship round this evening at 8 on Maine Public Television.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, one of our favorite guests is back on the program to talk about his just released book. Kenneth C. Davis is a New York Times bestselling author. His new book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. We invite you to join the conversation, but please do not call. Our phones are down. Please send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we will start with an email. This is from Ren. I was once told that my great-great-grandmother attributed her survival of the Spanish flu to eating oranges. Any idea if this would have helped, or was she just a lucky woman?
It may have helped. I mean, vitamin C, we're told, is useful when we're battling a cold or the flu, but I'm not sure that it would have been oranges alone. Most of the doctors who were watching this and trying to do just about anything found there were few effective remedies. Besides the fact there were few remedies available, we're talking about a time, of course, when aspirin was about the only wonder drug we had. There were no antibiotics yet. There was the doctor's kit included usually some aspirin and maybe some whiskey, and both were in high demand during the pandemic. But most agree that the survivors usually survived because of something simple, bed rest and tender, loving care. And that's one of the reasons that nurses played such a really important role in the Spanish flu and in World War I, and one of the reasons that this period transformed American society in some ways.
And one of the reasons, too, that so many soldiers were vulnerable, wasn't it, Kenneth? Is that not only did they have close quarters, but maybe were a little malnourished and exposed to the elements?
Absolutely. And of course, at that time, we were a much less urbanized nation. So a lot of these young men who were coming into these camps, crowded into camps with 55, 60,000 men in small barracks, sometimes in tents, they had never been exposed to most contagious diseases before.
So sure, they were coming off the farm and then being exposed to this.
That's right. And one of the real extraordinary parts of this flu, and we haven't discussed it quite yet, is that when we think of the flu today and who dies in the flu, typically it's the very old and the very young. Infants are most vulnerable, and elderly people. What was extraordinary about this pandemic was that it really seemed to be attacking and killing young people in much larger numbers than would be normal. And that's what some of the doctors were most confused by, that these otherwise healthy young men who reported to camp and were getting ready to go to war were dropping like flies in some cases. The death rate in some of the camps, like Fort Devens, Camp Devens near Boston, was 100 men a day. Doctors would say, and this was a routine description, the bodies are stacked like cordwood. It's difficult for us to imagine these sorts of scenes. They really do seem like they come out of a science fiction or, you know, a horror movie.
You know, it sounds so horrific, but there are some little lights. And I love the story that you write about Nancy Red Cloud. Would you share that with us?
Yeah, absolutely. This is there is a tremendous amount of first person narrative about people who had experienced this, or in some cases, second person. My father told me that when he was in camp, this is what it was like. But this was a Native American family that was working as essentially itinerant produce pickers. They went from the reservation and they went to somewhere in the Midwest and they picked potatoes and things. And they were told that this disease was coming and they should head home. And they could see the railroad cars bringing the bodies of soldiers back. And this is really extraordinary to hear this sort of first-person account. And this woman says that she and her family all did come down with the flu, but that their grandmother kind of took these very simple precautions and nursed them back to health. separated them so that they were in different tents, so she understood quarantine. She burned something that helped them breathe. So all of these very much natural homeopathic type of remedies were actually useful in this case. There were other homeopathic medicines that did nothing. And of course, the newspapers were filled with quack cures and all sorts of things you could buy, liniment, rubs, and none of them helped. Of course, the biggest symbol of prevention and care that existed at the time, and it's remarkable to look at the photographs, was the gauze mask. We see occasionally a person wearing a surgical mask around a city, and we think it's a little odd. In 1918, you were required in many cities to wear a gauze mask. You couldn't get on a streetcar in certain cities. In San Francisco, it was law. If you didn't have it on, you were called a mask slacker. You could be fined. There were fines in New York City for spitting on the subway because spit spreads death, as the signs would be on the streetcars. So it was this extraordinary moment in our history when this was everywhere present, but then forgotten.
And the gauze masks didn't really do anything at all, did they?
They did not. First of all, because gauze is not really sufficient enough to block a virus, which is so infinitesimally small. And that's another point here, that the idea of a virus was theoretic at the time. Bacteria had been seen by microscopes of that era, but viruses are too small to be seen by a traditional simple microscope. It would be another 20 years before a virus was actually seen. And that's one of the reasons that this was such a mystery. They didn't really understand what a virus was as opposed to a bacteria and how it could be kept out of the system. So the gauze masks proved very ineffective. People would use them poorly. They'd be dirty and they'd use them again. It was hopeless in most cases to do anything other than really quarantine yourself.
We have a tweet. Is it true that it was called Spanish because the Spanish press did not downplay death reports as much as that of other countries?
That's very close to what happened. Spain was a neutral country during World War I. It was out of the combat. All of the other combatant nations had press censorship, very rigorous, in many cases, voluntary press censorship. So this news of this epidemic really stayed under wraps in a lot of places. Because countries, first of all, didn't want to weaken morale in their own country. They didn't want the enemy to know how weakened they were by it. And just to keep patriotic spirits high, they didn't want to talk about how many people were dying every day. So Spain, in about just around 100 years ago, in May of 1918, the reports come out that the king of Spain is sick and that so many Spaniards in Madrid in particular are sick that they shut down the streetcar system. This report gets out, and almost instantly the flu gets the name Spanish flu, especially in the English-speaking world. I should point out that the Spanish called it the Naples soldier. Russians call it the German pest. Germans called it the Bolshevik flu or the Flanders fever. Almost every nation had its own way of describing this flu as it spread around the world.
And its own way of blaming someone else.
And always a way to blame someone else. In South Africa, whites called it the black disease and blacks called it the white disease.
Oh my gosh.
It's quite extraordinary to see that, but is now widely and most typically known as the Spanish flu, unfortunately for Spain.
And it's still unclear exactly where it started, but the first cases are here in the United States, correct?
The first recorded cases are at an army base in Kansas, but there's evidence that this flu was already working its way around, certainly in Kansas at that time. There were reports at San Quentin prison had a quarter of its inmates sick at around this time, that a Ford motor plant, Ford auto plant in Detroit had been shut down because so many workers were sick. So clearly it was starting to bubble around, this virulent and mutant virus. The other thing about it is that it came in clearly in waves. The first wave was in the springtime, typical of flu season, that it started in March and carried over into April, went into a bit of a lull in the United States, then apparently mutated because it was going back and forth, perhaps between Europe and China and India, and so many different versions of it started to circulate around, came back in with a real vengeance in the fall of 1918, when the true catastrophe hit. And that's, for instance, when Camp Devens in Ayers, Massachusetts, was hit so hard, they actually sent army doctors there to find out what was going on. And there were men who had seen plague and disease all over the world, and they said, "We don't know what this is. This is a new plague."
Virginia writes us in an email, "Like so many, I lost my grandmother from the Spanish flu after she gave birth to my mother. My birth grandfather already had several children. Thus, my mom was given to an aunt and uncle to raise. Many families were affected." And this story is one that you've discovered or talked about in the book, Kenneth, is these orphans or near orphans from the Spanish flu.
There were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of orphans, obviously from the flu, and it was true in large cities as well as small towns. And that that note is apt because you read accounts of because perhaps of the mentality or the morality at the time, that children were not believed to be well off with a single father. And so there are many, many cases, and I document a couple of them in the book, in which children were taken away from their father and sent off to live with an aunt, for instance, aunt and uncle, because they believed at the time, the social welfare agencies as they existed, that children shouldn't be left with just a father, presumably because the father has to work and he wouldn't be able to take care of them. So they had to be with a two-parent family. So there are many, many stories like that of this period, and many, many people talk about the difficulties of what this meant to lose one or both parents. I mentioned before that there's very little literature about this. The only other reference, significant reference to the flu and how it affected people, is Mary McCarthy's memoir called Memories of a Catholic Girlhood. She was a flu orphan and describes how she was then sent with her brothers to an aunt and uncle who sounded absolutely Dickensian in their cruelty to the children. So those are the sorts of human side of this incredible worldwide story that I try and give this story a human face with those kind of tales.
And Kenneth, you'll appreciate these two emails talking about the human story. This one's from Howard. He writes, "My grandfather, Chester Miller, died in the epidemic. He was a stonecutter in North Jay, Maine, in the granite quarries. He left a widow and a four-year-old daughter, my mother, and an eight-year-old son. My grandmother took in washing and managed to support the family with both children going to college. Those must have been trying times." And then, go ahead.
No, please.
And then Tracy, "Love the topic. My great-grandmother, Iva Fox, died of the Spanish flu in Dixmont, Maine. In rural Maine, neighbors took care of each other. When some neighbors became ill, Iva went there to care for them. She nursed them through the flu, but became ill herself. Because the neighbors were still too weak, there was no one to care for her. She died. It was an incredibly snowy winter, isolating many families. So snowy, in fact, Iva's body had to be removed through a second-story window. The snow was that deep."
Wow, what a story. I mean, these are the kind of stories that I've heard and read, and there are obviously millions of them around the country. And the disposal of bodies, not to be too grim about it, obviously that was an issue, became an issue in places. I mentioned, I think, that the doctors were reporting that bodies were stacked like cordwood in places like Camp Devens in Massachusetts, or in New York City, or an army base out in the Midwest. It's a phrase that I saw repeated time and time and time again. It's difficult for us to imagine. In Philadelphia, which is another really hard-hit city, they couldn't keep pace with the number of deaths. The funeral homes were overwhelmed. Grave diggers couldn't meet the demand. Families had to bury their own in many cases. There are also situations where the city then started to just dig mass graves with excavators. So a moment in our past that is completely unthinkable to us today, but it's clearly part of the American experience. And, you know, there are so many stories that I saw that do talk about people who were willing to sacrifice and willing to help, whether they're family members or their neighbors. At the same time, there was also the worst situations. In Philadelphia, for instance, where I talk about the funeral parlors, they jacked up the prices. So there is always somebody who's going to do the best in a crisis like this, and always people who are looking to make a buck from it. And unfortunately, that's part of human nature.
You're listening to Kenneth C. Davis. His most recent history book is for young adults, but it's a great read for adults too. More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. We're having trouble with the phones here today. They're not working. We'd love you to join the conversation via email, tweet, or Facebook. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does New England Cancer Specialists, 50 years of working toward better outcomes for Maine patients. Learn more at newenglandcancerspecialists.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Trump versus the Deep State. We talk with Evan Osnos of The New Yorker about how hundreds of nonpartisan civil servants considered not loyal enough to the administration have been sidelined or pushed out of government. Key positions have been left open to an unprecedented degree, leaving the president with few restraints on him. Join us.
That's Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. We hope you'll stay with us after Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, it's a discussion by Cisco Systems executives about internal innovation, empowering employees at all levels to share ideas, incubating new businesses, and turning disruptive concepts into emerging business models. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Spanish flu pandemic. My guest is familiar to Maine Calling listeners. Kenneth C. Davis is the New York Times bestselling author of America's Hidden History and Don't Know Much About History. We're discussing his brand new book, More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Our phones are down, so don't call. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Here's an email, Ken. I read that part of the search for the 1918 flu involved exhuming afflicted bodies from Alaska and various parts of the world. Can you comment on additional information regarding that process? That's from Susan. You write about this.
I do absolutely write about this. In fact, the book opens with a scene of a small fishing village in Alaska that is hit in November of 1918. And more than 70 of 80 inhabitants of this small village called Brevig Mission are dead within days. That's how astonishing and sudden and violent this illness was. They were buried in a mass grave, covered over, and because it was Alaska, that was permafrost that they were buried in. Many, many years later, someone had the idea that the secret to uncovering, because the secrets of the flu were a mystery, he had the idea that he could go to Alaska, perhaps exhume those bodies, and get some live Spanish flu virus. Today it would be something you'd do with biohazard. He basically went up there with a shovel and some garden shears and actually does it. He's not able to do the science with the tools he had at the time, which was in the 1950s, I believe. But he later then goes back a second time and provides some of the tissue that is eventually used, and I describe this in the latter part of the book, by going back to this town of Brevig Mission, he's able to bring back tissue that is then used to identify the exact flu and actually even replicate it. The Spanish flu gene has been brought back to life, so to speak, and that, of course, always worries some people.
And part of the mystery that only very recently was kind of figured out, only in, 2005, is what kind of virus this was.
That's right. They were able to gene sequence it and identify it as a form of avian flu, what some people would call bird flu. And so that's part of it. We know much more about this today than we did certainly 100 years ago, although still not everything. The question of the true origin point is not settled. The question of how it moved into the United States early in 1918 is not settled. Did it originate in Asia? Perhaps, most likely, was it in some aquatic bird that made the migration, and that bird, was eaten? Or, there's just no way to know who patient zero in this case was. Certainly wasn't the young man who was in the army camp who reports sick on March 4th, and he's a cook, and that begins the conflagration. We know it existed perhaps elsewhere. There's a suggestion that Chinese laborers who were brought across Canada by train to go from Canada to the front to dig trenches during the war might have been the carriers, that they were all crowded together on railroad cars and one of them was sick, and that was the origin point. No one can say with certainty.
Rodman sends an email. What lessons can we take from the Spanish flu to mitigate the spread and severity of modern pandemics like Ebola?
This is, of course, the reason we study history, Jennifer, and the reason that it's important to understand this pandemic and what it meant to the country and how it spread and why it spread. We obviously know a lot more about viruses and how to prevent them and how to deal with them, and we have vaccines and we have medications that can ease the really most dangerous aspects of flu, high fever, for instance. So we have more tools now than ever before. The real danger is, first of all, complacency, that we forget the basic rules of how to keep ourselves healthy. Wash your hands a lot, the CDC tells us. But there's a bigger story, I think, that I've tried to tell in this, is that part of the reason that the flu spread the way it did was fear, propaganda to some degree, and censorship. And in some cases, government officials, including the president and the leader of the American troops in Europe, Jack Pershing, they at a certain point were told not to bring any more men over. This is the fall of 1918, when really the contagion is at its worst. They feel that Germany is really ready to be pushed over. They don't want to stop the troop movements. There's no question that continuing to bring those soldiers across the Atlantic in these boats added to the tremendous loss of life. And of course, Germany itself, we talked earlier about the impact on the war. Germany was not able to fight. The German people were hit by the flu as well. And so the morale and the will to continue the war in Germany was also, I believe, affected by the flu. So the lessons are always important. But one clear one is that we should really make sure we understand what science knows and doesn't know. And if we get good, sound medical advice, we should pay attention to it. And this goes beyond the flu. This goes to all of the science that we are denying right now at very high levels of government. It's a very dangerous thing, in my opinion.
A related question, this is from Eliza. How do you envision the effect war would have at this time when the population is many times more than it was in 1918, when there is frequent and routine travel between continents? Could avoiding war be one of the most important preventative measures the world could take?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this crisis was worsened because there was a war going on. Not only the troops were crowded together, but there were refugees crowding into cities, millions of people on the move, hundreds of thousands of troops on the move. We don't have wars of that scale anymore, but we still certainly do. There's no question that if we were in a worldwide conflict of this nature, that always leads to the possibility of outbreaks of worse disease pandemics of this nature. So war is certainly one of the things that we have to worry about. We had a crisis in this country after 9/11 where we didn't know what the real danger was. We didn't know where it came from. And right after, so we started blaming people, and propaganda came into this, and we started to fear people. That happened in America in 1918. Then after 9/11, we had the anthrax scare. So put together those circumstances today, and we'd have a very, very different situation, maybe worsened by the fact that we do have this environment of people producing so-called fake news or spurious information. So what if somebody started to say, no, the vaccines are really dangerous, don't take the vaccine, even though we know it is effective in many cases. So all of those are part of the cautionary tale that the Spanish flu story should tell us.
A couple more personal stories. This is from Delene. She writes, my mother and brother were orphaned at ages 10 and 8 because their parents died in that flu epidemic, separated and sent to orphanages. They had a rough life. I'm glad to have this book to shed some light on the subject. Few people know how tough it was. And then from Linda, a happier tale. My grandmother had her first child in June of 1918, then was sick with the flu. I've been told that for some reason she was home alone with her infant son and took care of him and herself. She survived to have 6 more children and lived to the age of 92.
Well, that is a much happier story, and there are many more unhappy stories, unfortunately. There's one that I write about of someone in a tenement in St. Mark's Place in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, of course. And she's writing about laying there sick, and her husband has died already, and she can hear the horse clopping on the cobblestones outside, picking up the dead. It was that kind of almost, medieval, bring out your dead kind of moment, and many people had such experiences, not only in America, but around the world.
A question. The description sounds very much like the Black Death of the 1300s. Any chance of it being something like that? Has there been an investigation of the possibility? Do we know, and do you know, Kenneth, was the Black Death really a flu virus?
No, the Black Death was not a flu virus. The Black Death is actually a combination of several different diseases that I discuss actually in the back of the book. I offer a kind of a quick overview of medical history and how these diseases have been such influencers throughout history, but largely ignored. But no, the Black Death or the plague, the bubonic plague, is a very different disease from the flu.
So, Kenneth, to steal a little bit of your thunder, I'm going to read the last couple sentences in the book. But somebody asked, what are the lessons for today? And I think you sum it up well. You say, the story of the Spanish flu is about the truth. It is about how important it is to guard against that unreasoning terror that has no basis in fact or science. It is about the cost of ignorance. Understanding established facts and relying on knowledge to counteract faked news and outright propaganda is one of the most important lessons to be learned from the story of the Spanish flu.
Did I say that?
You wrote that. It's good.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And one of the reasons I love to write and talk about history is that it can teach us things. We've all heard that old cliche, but this is, a little bit different, I think, from a lot of the histories I've written in the past, because it is so it's so much about less about politics and wars or constitutional amendments, but this obviously affects people on a much more basic level in many ways and has throughout history.
We talk about the things that are similar between then and now, the quote-unquote fake news and propaganda and fear of science. But there are changes, aren't there? I mean, we do have a flu vaccine every year. We are able to get information out very quickly when something bad happens. Do you have some optimism that humanity will be able to avoid something like this happening again?
Well, I'm always optimistic, although perhaps less so at this point in our history and my life than I might have been a little while ago. But look, the dangers here are that we live in a world where people believe a lot of the things that they hear that may not be true. And obviously, I'm talking about things like vaccines being, you know, the cause of autism, which is by every medical account that I have read, not true, and leading to an increase in the incidence of mumps and measles around the country. That's a very dangerous thing. So I'm very, very leery of being too optimistic when I know that somebody can come along and really with a powerful megaphone or microphone or Twitter account make people do things that aren't in their best interest.
One more email, and I think this sums up a lot of what we've talked about, Kenneth. This is from Judith. My grandparents, wonderful storytellers, both of them were homesteading on the eastern plains of New Mexico during the flu epidemic. Some years ago, I was researching these years in their lives, sitting in the Dabaca County Courthouse going through old newspapers, when I realized with growing shock that one family after another, the homestead surrounding theirs had died from the flu. Full families. I loved my grandparents' stories and I paid attention, but I never heard one word from them about the flu from this time.
Very, very much to what we said at the beginning of the program, that people wanted to forget about this. It was so terrible that they didn't want to talk about it. It's like you had, you know, the worst skeleton in your closet that you were never going to talk about this. This was the skeleton in the nation's closet that many people did not want to talk about, and many people never heard about until fairly recently when it was a plot line on Downton Abbey, but a kind of minor one too, and it didn't really quite convey how dreadful and universal and international this pandemic was.
Well, Ken Davis, always a thrill to have you on the program. Kenneth C. Davis, the New York Times bestselling author of America's Hidden History. His newest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War.
Thank you, Jen, and now I'll go wash my hands.
Me too. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Just a quick note, we received more than 300 entries for our new theme music contest. We really appreciate all of the composers who took the time to create something special for us, and we hope to announce the winner very soon. Tomorrow on the program, The Improv Scene in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.